So starting in Genesis chapter 11 in verse 1, it says, "Now the whole world had one language and a common speech, and as men moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar, and they settled there." Immediately after the flood, of course, we read about, talked about Noah and about his family and about his three sons, and about that out of those three sons, then the world was populated. There's no really way to know this, but it's kind of believed that there were possibly about 30,000 people at this point who inhabited the world. Now, you can say, give me 30,000 people who inhabited the regional world of Abraham or the whole world. Well, we just don't know. We just have no idea. It depends on whether you think it was a local flood or a worldwide flood. But we think, as reading from the genealogies of Noah, that counting everything, you know, this is this generation, you have maybe about this many kids per generation, blah, 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 blah. They estimate there's about 30,000 people who are moving towards the plain of Shinar at this time. And that is, let's see, you guys see that okay? Do we need to turn the lights down a little bit? Can we turn the lights down just a little bit? Guys, see if that would help a little bit. Thing doesn't work. Anyway, the plain of Shinar was kind of between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. And I don't think this thing works here. No, it doesn't. Larry? Am I hitting the wrong thing? What was it? What am I hitting? That's what I thought. Yeah, that's what I was hitting. Yeah. But I got to go back to my deal now. Yeah. There you go. Plain Shinar is like right here. Down here is the Gulf of Aqaba. And over here is the eastern side, I guess you might want to say, of Israel. Kind of that area. Israel's right over here. And so they think the Plain of Shinar was right here. The cradle of civilization, as we call it. And this is where the people moved, and they settled there. And when they got there, they decided to build a tower. And we know it as the Tower of Babel. It was called a ziggurat, or ziggurat. And this is, they think, well, this is kind of what it looked like. This is what a typical ziggurat looked at that time. And they were, it's kind of a big word, you can use that and impress your friends at work tomorrow. But this is what the most of them look like that they've discovered back then. And even today, people in the Middle East, when they build towers, they kind of use this same design of a very wide base and then kind of a stair step thing up here. And so we don't know if this is what it looked like, but this is kind of the way they looked back then. And we all know the story of the Tower of Babel. That all of them decided, well, let's build this great tower. Let's build a city to ourselves, to our own name, and build a tower to ourselves. And God said, nah, I don't want you to do that. So that wouldn't be a good plan, because I told you to replenish the earth, remember? So replenish the earth doesn't mean replenish the plain of Shinar. And so he comes down and confuses their language. How that happened, there's just a lot of speculation. Was he talking about the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit coming down and confusing the language, or who was he talking about? We're really just not sure. But however it was that they confused the language, and as a result, because they couldn't talk to each other anymore, then all the people who could talk with each other went one way, and all the people who spoke this other language went another way, and all the people who spoke another language went another way, and so forth. But some people remained there in that area, and in fact, historians named the place Babylon after Babel. Does that make sense? They think that's possibly where the name Babylon came from, was originated from the phrase Babel, and so that's where modern-day Babylon was. Modern-day Babylon, there is no modern-day Babylon. Ancient Babylon was there, was in that plain. And so they stayed there and populated the earth, and everybody else just kind of moved on out. Here's some lessons from the Tower of Babel that we need to learn. Number one, sin is a constant problem. Even though God had destroyed the earth, because of every inclination in the heart of man was thinking about evil all the time, which is pretty bad, and he destroys the earth of that because of that. As soon as they get populated big enough to hang out with each other, it goes back to the same thing. Everybody starts doing the same thing again. And so sin is a constant problem. Lesson number two is God is to be obeyed no matter what. If God said replenish the earth, God means replenish the earth. He didn't mean replenish part of the earth or replenish or don't replenish or do whatever you want to do. That God is to be obeyed no matter what. If you don't obey God because of a rebellious spirit, then you're going to suffer the consequences of that. And we'll talk about that more next week. We talk about Sodom and Gomorrah. A couple weeks ago, we were up in New York City, went down to Greenwich Village and got off the subway, came up to the top, right in the middle of the gay pride parade. Yeah, I'll tell you all about that when we talk about Sodom and Gomorrah. It was an eye-opening experience. I didn't take any pictures. But God is to be obeyed no matter what. Lesson number three, making a name for yourself rarely works out. Making a name for yourself rarely works out. So if that is you, you think that's your calling in life, is to make a name for yourself, to have people remember you, to have people remember who you are and what you did and what you stood up for, even for spiritual things. I'm going to make a name for myself. I'm doing it to the glory of God. That rarely works out for most people. In fact, we're going to change that to it never works out. But I thought I'd say that sarcastically. Lesson number four, God's plans cannot be thwarted. You cannot change the plans of God. Doesn't mean that we can't pray for God to change His mind, which He does. Doesn't mean that we can't question the plans of God and say, why are you doing it this way? But ultimately, God's plans will not be thwarted. They cannot be changed. And so we need to learn to just be submissive to all that and to go along for the ride instead of telling God all the time how the ride should be. So what we've covered up to this point then is we've covered prehistory, which is chapters 1 and 2. We put a little check mark by that. Primeval history, chapters 3 through 11, you check that off. And now we're going to spend the rest of the time in Genesis talking about what we call patriarchal history. And that's the story of Abraham and Jacob and Joseph. And we'll throw Isaac in there just for, a little good luck and talk about him just a little bit. But primarily we're going to talk about Abraham and Jacob and Joseph until the class is over with. Abraham, starting in chapter 12. Really, Abraham starts in chapter 11 when it says that his father, Terah, had three boys. Their son's name were Abram, Nahor, and Haran. And Haran became the father of Lot. We're starting on chapter 11, starting in verse 27, I think it is. While his father, Terah, was still alive, Haran, that is Lot's daddy, died in Ur of the Chaldeans, and we'll show about just a little bit where that is, in the land of his birth. Abram and Nahor both married. The name of Abraham's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife was Milcah. She was the daughter of Haran, the father of both Milcah and Ishtar, and now Sarai was barren. She had no children. Terah took his son Abram, his grandson Lot, son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law Sarai, the wife of his son Abram. And together they set out from Ur of the Chaldeans to go to Canaan. But when they came to Haran, they settled there. Terah lived 205 years and he died in Haran. Abraham's life is defined by a couple of things. First of all, the significant people that will be in his life. And in his life, there are a lot of significant people. Historical characters are in the life of Abram. And so we'll talk about that. Three particularly really stand out. And it's also defined by significant events. A lot of events that we talk about as we study the Bible. Well, that's not sounding good. What happened? Oh, and maybe I'll ratchet it down a little bit. Ratchet that down just a tad. A lot of significant events are tied back to Abraham. Events that we all know about, that we are familiar with, that we were taught about when we were little bitty kids in vacation Bible school and Bible class are tied back to Abraham. So we'll talk about all those. This is a travel of Abraham, if you guys can see this. Right here is basically where they think the plain of Shinar was, or Ur of the Chaldeans. And so Terah was here. There's Ur. It's not there anymore, but it was at the time. And so they go in a northwest direction. And it says they, and you can see they're kind of on the outskirts of Assyria, along this borderland, going up, basically running up the Euphrates River is the way they traveled. And they come up to Haran. What they were planning to do was come all the way down here to the land of Canaan. But they got as far as this, and this is where Abram's father died, Terah died. He died at Haran. Okay? And this is where it says that when the Lord comes to Abram, it appears. Chapter 12, and verse 1. The Lord had said to Abram, "Leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land I will show you." So possibly he told him this down here. Some believe this is where it happened. But right here, whether it's here or here, God had a conversation, his first conversation with Abraham, with Abram. Now, what was special about Abram that he would have a conversation with him? Nothing that we know of. When Joshua talks to the people, you know, about coming to the land of Canaan, he says, he talks about worshiping the God of the Amorites that your fathers worshiped beyond the river. And that was what Abram grew up in, a household of worshiping false gods. There's nothing, as far as we can tell, that there was special about Abram that he had denied the false gods or anything like that by the time he got to Haran, if that is exactly where God first talked to him. We just don't know. But there was something about him that God said, you know, you're the one I want to talk to about all this. Some say it was his faith. I think it's just because God picked him out. I think it was the grace of God as to why he picked out Abraham. I don't think it's anything more than that. I don't think it's anything more than that as to why he chose the nation of Israel as opposed to the nation of Babylon. I think God said, I'll take you. And I'll raise you up and make you into a great nation. And just to throw this in, there's a great lesson there for us. Is that we don't need to think... You guys still hear me okay? Okay. We don't need to think that God is going to use us because of who we are or because of our great talents, and that we can't be used until we get talented. That's just not true. God just says, I'll take you. Why does he pick me? I have no earthly idea. I wouldn't have picked me. If I had that power, I'd look down and say, I'm not that guy. That's not the guy I want. But it's like Richard was talking about the other night in Bible class. Who was he talking about? Moses. Yeah. Why Moses? He's talented. He had all that. But until he was totally untalented, was this obscure shepherd who didn't want to be picked. God says, okay, now I can use you. It's the grace of God. And I hope you're seeing that the grace of God runs all the way through the book of Genesis. Over and over again, God uses people. You say, well, I don't believe that. Wait till we get to Jacob and you'll really believe it. Because there was a guy who we would have never picked. It was Jacob, and God says, I'm going to name you. I'm Jacob, and I'm even going to name the nation of Israel after you. So, pretty interesting. So, God has a talk with Abram here, we'll say, and then he goes on, he says, and this is his first time he's blessing. He says, I will make you into a great nation, starting in chapter 12 and verse 2. I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. Not only I'll make you a blessing, but you'll be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. Whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. So Abram left as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he set out from Haran. And that's why I'm thinking this is where he had the conversation with him at originally. He took his wife Sarai, his nephew Lot, all the possessions they had accumulated, and the people they had acquired in Haran. And don't get too thrown by this, but Abraham was a slaveholder. Everybody with me? Abraham was a slaveholder, so don't be threatened by that. That's just what he was. And they set out for the land of Canaan, and they arrived there. Abram traveled throughout the land as far as the site of the great tree of Moab at Shechem. Abram, for some reason, I don't know what it was, but he was always settling near trees. Great trees. He didn't settle beside little scrub brushes. He settled beside great trees. The great tree of Moreb, the great tree of Mamre. That's where he always liked to settle. He's the first environmentalist, I guess. At that time, the Canaanites were in the land. The Lord appeared to Abram and said, "To your offering I will give you this land." So he built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him. Let's read the rest of this and we'll come back and talk about it. From there he went on toward the hills east of Bethel, and he pitched his tent west of Bethel and at Ai on the east. There he built an altar to the Lord and called on the name of the Lord. Then Abraham set out and continued toward the Negev. Everywhere Abram went, he built an altar to the Lord. When he went to sacrifice his son, what did he go do? He went there to build an altar to sacrifice him on. He just thought that way. That's just the way he thought. I don't think that way. That's just not who I am. I don't think spiritually. Steve Sapp one time said, "I don't have a spiritual bone in my body." I related probably as much to anything as Steve ever said as that. I don't have a spiritual bone in my body. I just don't think that way. Some people do. Abram thought that way. He was always building altars to the Lord, and you can pretty much trace where he went by the altars that he built. That's a whole sermon in and of itself. And so this is his journey. This is another map. This one's not very good, but you can see he comes down here, and then it says there was a famine in the land, and he goes to Egypt. So we think he went this way and crossed over here into Egypt pretty much around the tip of the Red Sea, and then he eventually goes back up to here. So Abraham in Egypt, well, what was that like? Let's talk about that just for a minute, why he went there. Well, first of all, can y'all see that? Yeah, this is a picture of the Negev. It says he went toward the Negev. The Negev was in the southwest corner of modern-day Israel, headed down towards Egypt. You remember when it says that that Philip went down to the Ethiopian eunuch and met him on the road to Gaza? That's where they were. They were in the Negev. That's where they were. And so it's the southwest corner. It is much like southwest United States. It's a lot like Arizona. I don't think they got any immigration laws they're discussing down there, but it's southwest part of Israel. And it's kind of a unique place even today. It's grazing land. If you can see this, it's got a little scrub brush here. And it's only grazing land during the spring and the summer. And what they would do is, the Bedouins, is that they would bring their crops down, their sheep down here, and feed them in the spring and summer down here. And then when it got winter, of course, all that dried up and died. And then they would take them back up to the northwest side of Israel, where it was more, where they could feed them up there. And so this is what the Negev was used for. So for Abraham to go down through here, that's what generations had been doing. They would go towards the Negev if they had sheep and so forth. And that's where they'd feed their sheep out during the spring and summertime. The Negev covers 55% of Israel's territory. And when the nation of Israel was established, quick little history lesson here, they pretty much took over the Negev and turned it almost into a reservation for the Bedouins, who'd lived there all their lives, generations. And so they confined them there, pretty much took away their means of livelihood, and then eventually came in and established settlements there to where the Bedouins, they exist in a very small as comparison, whereas before this is where generations and had lived in the Negev. You probably didn't want to know all that, but I thought that was pretty interesting. So yeah, I thought it was pretty cool. So he goes to the Negev, and then it says, he went down to Egypt because the famine was severe. So there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down to Egypt to live there for a while because the famine was severe. Why did he go to Egypt? Egypt that's where everybody goes when the famine comes. You wouldn't think that today, but that's where everybody in the Middle East went to during times of famine, and it had to do because of the Nile River. The Nile River flows out of the Mediterranean Sea, I believe it is, and flows all the way down to the Gulf of Aqaba. I think that is, I might be wrong on that. I'm probably wrong on that. I don't think it goes to the Gulf of Aqaba. I think it empties out somewhere else. Which way? Goes up. Well, it's the only river in the world that goes north. Is that right? I think that's right, yeah. I must have been standing on my head when I read the map. And what the Egyptians had learned to do, and this is a famous, if you guys can see this, this is a famous part of a sculpture that was discovered. And it shows a guy here who's an Egyptian, and he's leaning over. You see this little trapdoor thing looking here? Looks like a tombstone. And what that is a gate to the river. And what they would do is that they would, and you see he has a little deal here he's holding up. They would pull this gate up, and then the water would flow from here out into the fields. And what they did is they built these little canals off of the Nile River. And so they'd open up these gates, and the water would flow out and flood the fields, and so that they could grow their crops. That's why they had all this fertile farmland when nobody else had it back then. Because they figured out this very creative irrigation system. That's why they kept going down there. A few years ago, I was flying out to Palm Springs, California to work, which isn't a bad gig, to say the least. Yeah, that's a nice gig. And we flew over an arid part of southwest United States. I'm not sure we were. We may have been maybe in the northwest corner of Arizona, which is very arid. And there was this green patch of land just out in the middle of nowhere. But what it was beside the river. And they were irrigating water off the river to flood that piece of land. And it was just so weird because it was like out in the middle of this desert. You see this big old green patch of land. And that's what they had done. Well, that's what they were known for. And that's why they kept going to Egypt, because they had flooded the lands and they grew their crops there. And so later on, his grandson Jacob, remember, he'd send the boys down there. Send his family down there too, because once more, this was still in effect, probably 100 years later, they still did that. Let's see. Yeah, you might want to write this down if you're interested in this sort of thing. The Egyptians created 1.5 to 2.5 million tons of corn per year back then. 1.5 to 2.5 million tons of corn per year. They generated that. They were known as the breadbasket of the Roman world. So when Rome would have its famines, which they all did back then, they would actually import corn from Egypt. Now, if you were to go to Egypt today, you wouldn't see all that. It's changed radically. But pretty much, they were known for that back then. So that's why it goes there. Now, let's see, we want to go back. Let's talk about this just for a minute. Because here's a really interesting story that ought to give you hope that if you're a big fat liar, you can still get to go to heaven. All the men are going, thank you, Jesus. Okay. As he was about to enter Egypt, he said to his wife, Sarai, I know what a beautiful woman you are. Now, she's 60 years old. I don't get it. I'm teasing. I need to bring out a few rocks, you know, stoning. Yeah. I had a teacher where I went to school, Fried Hardeman. He used to say, they said, I don't get it. What is it here? What's funny is when they go to Abimelech, like when she's 85, they bring up the same situation. He says, I know what a beautiful woman you are. He says it again, you know. So Sarah must, you know, she's a beautiful woman. It's enough that he was worried about Pharaoh taking her his wife. When the Egyptians see you, they will say, this is his wife. Then they will kill me, but will let you live. Say you are my sister, which technically she was. Technically she was his sister. Because, what was it, his father had married somebody else? and had her. So she was like a half sister to him. She was his stepsister or whatever. Then they will say to your sister that I will be treated well for your sake, and my life will be spared because of you. And Sarai buys into it. Probably because he said, you're such a beautiful woman. She goes, oh. Well, sure, honey. Whatever you say. Gentlemen, let this be a lesson to all of us. Now, what I do want you to look is, I want you to look in chapter 20 and verse 13 real quick. Chapter 20 and verse 13. The same thing happens with Abimelech. And this is how Abraham replies to him. Abraham replied, starting in verse 11, I said to myself, there is surely no fear of God in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife, because she really is my sister, the daughter of my father, though not of my mother, and she became my wife. And when God told me, had me wander from my father's household, notice what he's doing now. God's fault. I said to her, this is how you can show your love to me. Tad manipulative, isn't it? Just a tad. This is how you can prove your love to me, honey. Lie for me. And I think the reason I wanted to bring all that up is that I think we need to see that no matter what our worst nature is, that God can still use us in spite of how we are. That, you know, here he uses a liar and a manipulator. Later on, he would use just a crook. Jacob was just a crook. Joseph was just, and don't anybody get offended, he was just an arrogant little brat who was mean-spirited. David was a murderer, an adulterer. Peter, you know, we go on and on and on. God could use you at your basest nature if you're willing to let Him use you. So don't ever give up hope. Don't ever think, oh, I'm this way, God would not use me. It's just not true. So He uses Abraham. Abram, He will use you. So this happens. Pharaoh catches him in the middle of it, mainly because it says in verse 17 of chapter 12, the Lord inflicted serious diseases on Abraham and his household because of Abram's wife Sarah. So Pharaoh summons Abram. He says, what have you done to me? Why didn't you tell me she was your wife? Why did you say she is my sister? So I took her to be my wife. Now, then here's your wife. Take her and go. I don't care how good looking she is. This is hurting me. This is killing me. And I think, I'm wondering if God did not come to Pharaoh in a dream, you know, and tell him all this, just like he did Abimelech. Then Pharaoh gave orders about Abram to his men, and they sent him on his way with his wife and everything he had. And if you look back up in verse 16, it says that Pharaoh treated Abram well for her sake, and Abram acquired sheep, cattle, male and female donkeys, men servants, maid servants, and camels. He got wealthy off of this lie. Now, don't anybody think that's a good idea? He got wealthy off of this lie. Pharaoh sends him out, and Abram did not say, let me return all the things to you I got wealthy off of. Which tells you a little bit more about Abraham's character. He struggled just a little bit with materialism, like we all do. Okay? Now, I hope you're not thinking, boy, this is really destroying my view of him. But it really does need to give you a more realistic view of who he was. Okay? So he gets all this stuff, he takes it with him, and they leave. Chapter 13. The first dealings we have with Lot. So Abraham went from Egypt to the Negev with his wife and everything he had, and Lot went with him. Abraham had become very wealthy in livestock and in silver and gold because of his lie down in Egypt. And so they go back to the Negev. They're back up in the southwestern corner again, grazing their flocks. And it says, from the Negev, he went from place to place until he came to Bethel, to the place between Bethel and Ai. And remember, Ai will play a later big role in the taking of the Promised Land. Because that's the place where the Israelites try and take over without inquiring of God about it, and they get beat like a drum, and so God talks to Joshua and kind of fixes things there. That's Ai. Where his tent had been earlier, where he had first built an altar, there Abraham called on the name of the Lord. So he goes back there, probably thankfully just got out of Egypt by the skin of his teeth, wealthy, you know, didn't get killed. And so they go back up, and they come to the land between Ai and Bethel. And we'll come and look at where that is in just a minute. It says, now Lot, who was moving about with Abram, had flocks and herds and tents, but the land could not support them while they stayed together, for their possessions were so great that they were not able to stay together. And quarreling arose between Abram's herdsmen and the herdsmen of Lot. The Canaanites and Perizzites were also living in the land at that time. Do you notice how in verse 7, the end of that, God keeps throwing that back in there? This is the second time He said it. He says the Canaanites were living in the land at the time. I have no idea why He throws that in there, but He keeps doing it. He keeps bringing that up, that the Canaanites also lived in the land at the time. It may be because He was trying to differentiate between between Abram and the Canaanites. We just don't know. So Abram said to Lot, let's not have any quarreling between you and me or between your herdsmen and mine, for we are brothers. That's in Genesis chapter 13 and verse 8. Is not the whole land before you? Let's part company. If you go to the left, I'll go to the right. If you go to the right, I'll go to the left. And now you see another character of significance is Lot. And here's the character of Lot. Lot looked up and saw that the whole plain of the Jordan was well watered, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt towards Zoar. He'd just been down to Egypt. He comes back and says, oh, this is like Egypt. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. So Lot chose for himself the whole plain of the Jordan and set out toward the east. Looks can be deceiving. Are you with me? Don't fall for it. Don't fall for something that looks so, so cool, so great to everyone else, when it could really be dangerous. It could be the worst thing you could ever buy into. And we'll talk more about the gay pride parade next week. I'm just going to tell you some of the things I saw. It made me realize, wow, what have these poor young men and women bought into? It was a very, very saddening thing. But it makes me think of this, that Lot just missed it. Because this ended up being his destruction. Ended up killing his wife. Ended up destroying his daughters. Ended up destroying generations beyond him. The Moabites and the Ammonites basically were destroyed because Lot looked towards Sodom and Gomorrah, saw it was well pleasing to the eye, and went for it. And so they separate, and Lot goes there. Abraham's still standing up on top of the mountain thinking, okay, this is what I got. And God comes to him, and he says, Lot, he says, Abram, I want you to walk all over the breadth of the land. I want you to look north, south, east, west. East is also where Lot moved, right? He said, all this is going to belong to you. And it's because of Abraham's faith and because of his generous spirit at this point. The Battle of the Kings, chapter 14. This is one of the great stories about Abram, that we don't talk about very much. And starting in chapter 14 and verse 1. It says, at that time, and we're not going to read all those guys, can't pronounce their names anyway, all the latter kings joined forces in the valley of Siddim, the Salt Sea. For 12 years they've been subject to Kedar Lamar, but in the 13th year they rebelled. There was these five kings. One of them's name is Kedar Lamar. And he had all these guys who were his buddies. And when it says kings here, it means city kings. Okay? It probably means city kings. They were just kings of cities. That's the way they looked at them. There are five kings. Kedar Lamar was kind of the head guy. And he had all these buddies. Well, they kind of ruled all these other four little kings, and they made him pay tribute to them. And so in about, it says, for 12 years, that 13th year, one of them said, hey, we're tired of paying tribute. Let's go in rebellion. And so they rebel against them. Okay? And what else? let's back up just a little bit. We don't go there just yet. And so they have this rebellion. Well, the five kings meet the four kings in this battle of the nine kings in the Valley of Siddim. And there were tar pits there, kind of like the little Bray tar. Anybody seen the little Bray tar pits before? Seen pictures of them? Yeah, pretty cool. So I've seen pictures. Never been there. So anyway, so they had a big battle there, and then the four kings, they kind of got the tar pits. Well, they captured them all, beat them up. They go back down to Sodom in the meantime, and there's Lot living there. Now it says Lot's living in the city, and they take him as captive and run off with him. Well, something about Abram that we never think about, Abram gets 300 men. And it says, if you will look, I want you to look at a particular verse. Verse 13. One who escaped came and reported this to Abram, the Hebrew. First time he's called a Hebrew. You want to write that down in your Bible. First time the word Hebrew is mentioned. He was known as Abram, the Hebrew. Now what's interesting is most biblical scholars think, that name Hebrew was given to him by the people of Canaan. They called him a Hebrew. Possibly because he's living in Hebron. Possibly it means something else. Someone who's different. But a Hebrew was a name that was attached to him. It wasn't a name that necessarily God gave him. Now Abraham was living near the where? Great trees. Of Mamre the Amorite, a brother of Eshcol and Anar, Aner, all of whom were allied with Abraham. These are his three best friends, and they are what? They're Canaanites. His three best friends are people who lived in the land of Canaan. In fact, they were Amorites. When Abram heard that his relative had been taken captive, he called out the 300 trained men born in his household. He's got a pretty big house now, doesn't he? And went in pursuit as far as Dan. During the night, he divided his men to attack them, and he routed them, pursuing as far as north of Damascus. He gathered all the goods, brought them back, his relative Lot and his possessions, together with the women and the other people. So Abram is not only a great farmer, you know, he's not all these other things, but he's kind of like the Napoleon of his time. That's kind of who he is. He's this military leader. He figures out, divide your forces, attack them. He's only got 318 guys, and he attacks these forces that possibly are in the thousands. Routs them, captures Lot, all the people of Sodom, and he brings them back. Which is really kind of a cool thing. We don't ever think about Abraham, but that's what he did. Okay? So what I want you to do is, I want you to mark your place, okay? And next week when we come back, we'll talk about what happened after that. Because it's 20 till, and I think Richard's standing up. Yeah. Which means... So we got further than I thought we did. Thanks for paying attention. Go get your children and hustle on back because of the big presentation.